Area Voices, and Setlist.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. Taiwan is holding its largest ever war games to test its capabilities in case of a Chinese invasion. We have views from Taiwan and Beijing. Plus, Republican Senator Tom Tillis is retiring, leaving the race for the North Carolina seat wide open. And the author of A New Whodunit tells us why people love murder mysteries.
Most of us can stop before we do something terrible. And so this is generally a story about somebody who couldn't stop, and they went on to do the terrible thing.
It's Sunday, July 13th. News is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Danny Freer with the Up North Report. A Manobin County Sheriff's deputy was arrested Tuesday for drunk driving. According to the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead, 52-year-old Richard Overing crashed his pickup into a ditch. The criminal complaint states that on the day of the crash, Overing told a state trooper he had 10 vodka drinks. A breath test showed he had a blood alcohol content of 0.28%. The legal limit is 0.08. Overing appeared in Manobin County District Court Wednesday. He faces a gross misdemeanor charge for a DWI, with up to almost a year in jail if convicted. The Forum reports Overing has 4 previous convictions for driving under the influence of alcohol. The long-awaited felony burglary trial of State Senator Nicole Mitchell begins Monday. The Minnesota Reformer reports 2 legislative sessions have wrapped since Mitchell was arrested in Detroit Lakes, where police allege they found her in her stepmother's basement. The DFL represents Woodbury in the East Metro. Mitchell's trial was delayed a month because of the assassination of Speaker Emerita Melissa Hortman and attempted assassination of Senator John Hoffman. Jury selection begins Monday in Detroit Lakes. Opening statements are expected Monday afternoon or Tuesday. Mitchell is accused of breaking into her stepmother's home, where she says she was trying to retrieve some of her late father's possessions. This included his ashes. She has pleaded not guilty. Denise Slipey announced she will run to represent State Senate District 6. The DFLer lost to Republican Kerry Heintzman in a special election in April to replace former Senator Justin Eichhorn. Heintzman won by 20 percentage points. Heintzman has not formally announced she will run again, but she did collect donations for a 2026 run prior to the special election. Slipey will campaign on a few key issues: the environment, economy, health care, education, and mining. U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar spoke on the Senate floor Wednesday to defend federal funding for public media. Her speech comes the week before the Senate will vote on whether to rescind funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The organization is a nonprofit that funds mostly local public television and radio stations. KAXE relies on this funding for 12% of our budget. Klobuchar was on the KAXE morning show on Friday, where she restated her support for rural stations like KAXE and the important services they provide.
Emergency alerts. I've been using the example in speeches on the Senate floor about how, you know, it's only maybe in the northern Minnesota radio, community radio stations that you're going to hear about, well, what's still happening with those Canadian wildfires, or where's the road flooded, or when is the softball game.
The House narrowly voted to rescind funding last month. The Senate is expected to vote Wednesday. They can make amendments to the rescission package, which would be sent back to the House for another vote. President Donald Trump posted on Truth Social on Thursday that he would not endorse lawmakers who do not vote to pull funding. The deadline to pass the rescission is July 18th. Hear Klobuchar's full interview with The Morning Show at our website, KAXE.org. A new cancer center is open at Astera Health in Wadena. Leaders hosted a ribbon-cutting ceremony to celebrate the center on Tuesday. The Coborn Cancer Center took about 2 years to build and cost $24 million. The center will provide cancer treatment for patients in central Minnesota. It includes 8 private treatment rooms and a PET CT scanner. It also has a machine called a linear accelerator, which provides tattoo-free radiation treatment. Since planning for the center began in 2021, the goal has been to provide quality care with a shorter driving distance for rural Minnesotans. A shortage of cancer care in rural areas contributes to a gap in preventable deaths from the disease. The Rural Cancer Institute reports that although death rates for cancer are falling overall, that trend is slower in rural communities. The center will welcome its first patient on Monday. That's it for the Up North Report. You can find more of our stories at KAXE.org, where you can also find content from our music, morning show, and phonology teams. I'm Dani Freire, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
ER.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. We start this hour in Taiwan, where the island's annual military exercise is underway. The 10-day drill is one of the largest in Taiwan's history and is designed to bolster the island's defenses against a possible invasion from China. As Yan Kamenzin Broomby reports from the capital, Taipei, the exercise also includes new weapons systems provided by the U.S.
It was at a school in western Taiwan that this year's Hangguang drills began. In the rooms where toddlers usually learn their ABCs, rifles and military equipment litter the floor. The corridors may be empty of students, but there's a different class taking place. Reservists have been invited, kitted out with uniforms and guns, and are being shown how to use them. But it's not just soldiers that are involved. Customers at this supermarket were surprised when, in a simulation, a shop worker announced a missile had struck northern Taipei. And elderly shoppers were rushed to the basement. It's part of Taiwan's new focus on whole society resilience, as supermarket representative Liu Hongzheng explains.
The government wants civilians in their daily lives to be ready in case there is war. This drill is an air raid exercise.
Beijing, which claims sovereignty over Taiwan, has described the exercises as a bluff. China has always maintained Taiwan will be unified with the Chinese mainland by force, if necessary. Their threats that Taiwan legislator Michelle Lin is familiar with.
No matter what we do or don't do, if someone wants to attack you, they will invade you. So this time, we comprehensively trained all of these together, conducting exercises that cover everything.
New weapons are also being tested, chiefly HIMAR missile systems and Abrams tanks, both imported from the United States. For legislator Lin, a symbol of cooperation between Taipei and Washington, but also a reminder. The Trump administration has put increasing pressure on Taiwan to pay more for its own defense.
On one hand, we buy weapons from the U.S. for our defense. On the other hand, the U.S. has always hoped that we can improve our capabilities in developing our own indigenous defense weapons.
As the exercises continue, they therefore serve as a signal, not only to China, but also to Washington, that Taiwan is willing to invest in its own security. And for Taiwanese society, the Hangguang are a wake-up call and a message that the risk of conflict is increasing, and when it comes, society will need to be ready. For NPR News, this is Yan Kamenzin-Brumby in Taipei.
We're joined now by Yoon Soon, director of the China program at the Stimson Center. Good morning and welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So what's China's calculus when it comes to these military drills?
I think from the Chinese perspective, unless there is a U.S. military intervention, Taiwan's defense capability is not going to be sufficient to counter a Chinese invasion or Chinese gray zone activities. So when China looks at the military drills this year in particular, I think Beijing sees more political messaging or political symbolism rather than an actual mobilization to fight against China, which from the Chinese perspective, Taiwan alone simply does not have the capability. So I think Beijing would see this as a calling for Washington to pay more attention to Taiwan's defense need and also pay more attention to the heightened perception of a potential Chinese invasion of Taiwan in the coming 2 years, in 2027, the famous 2027 window of Chinese invasion of Taiwan.
Well, and Beijing's longstanding policy is reunification with Taiwan. If the U.S. is distracted elsewhere, do you think a Chinese invasion of the island is a real possibility?
Well, there's always a possibility of the Chinese invasion of Taiwan. The question is, what are the conditions that would trigger such an invasion, right? I think from the Chinese perspective, they have always made it clear they prioritize peaceful unification because it is less costly and also has a higher chance of victory. Remember, even if U.S. is distracted somewhere else, it does not guarantee that U.S. is not going to step in if China decides to invade Taiwan unprovoked. So U.S. has an obligation. Remember, we have a Taiwan Relations Act, a domestic legislation, mandates that the U.S. government will have to supply for Taiwan self-defense. So the key question is that if U.S. does invade, does China still have a clear chance of success? I think the answer to that question, or the uncertainty of the answer to that question, is exactly what has kept China at bay, that the Chinese uncertainty about the potential result of such an invasion may not be victorious.
How is Beijing looking at U.S. support for Taiwan at this moment, especially with President Trump right now? You know, he's called for Taiwan to spend more money on its defense. How do they view that relationship between the U.S. and Taiwan?
I think from Beijing's perspective, U.S. support of Taiwan is always there, but the degree of the support can vary, right? So in the past, for example, Biden administration, I think the Chinese have perceived a heightened level of support, both diplomatically, rhetorically, politically, in terms of the U.S. policy, as well as in terms of military defense. But coming to President Trump, I think that is the message of uncertainty received by both Beijing and Taipei, because honestly, President Trump has not publicly stated a unequivocal support of Taiwan in the event of a Chinese attack of the island. So that sends a message of question, I think, both in Beijing and in Taipei, that what does this mean? What is exactly U.S. policy? Is U.S. commitment to Taiwan still firm? And can we still proceed as before? I think it does send a potential curious question to Beijing that, well, does this offer us an opportunity that maybe U.S. will not step in the event of a Chinese invasion? So maybe this could be our opportunity for unification. But remember, again, the Chinese will prepare for the military capability, and they will ask the question, and the uncertainty is what keeps them at bay.
That's Yoon Soon from the Stimson Center. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
French President Emmanuel Macron and British Prime Minister Keir Starmer met last week to discuss Ukraine and migration. But the two allies also discussed another conflict, one that goes way back to the year 1066. From London, NPR's Lauren Freyer explains.
On this hillside, on Saturday the 14th of October 1066, a single battle between a few thousand men permanently changed the course of history in England and beyond.
It was the Battle of Hastings, the start of the Norman conquest, as this BBC documentary explains, when William, Duke of Normandy, better known as William the Conqueror, led an army from France that invaded England, killed its King Harold with an arrow to the eye, and installed William on his throne. But there are no hard feelings.
Britons are great, by the way, of making a great triumph out of a defeat. And I studied history at Oxford. My courses started at 1066.
Sarah Baxter is an antiquities expert who, like generations of school kids here, learned their country's history began in 1066. There's a popular satirical history book called 1066 and All That. The date is even immortalized in a ubiquitous car insurance ad on TV.
Okay. Hastings Direct, refreshingly straightforward insurance.
0800 00 1066.
Or visit our website.
And so when French President Macron visited, British Prime Minister Starmer stood next to him and waxed poetic about that 1066 battle that his country lost. Because it was the beginning, he said,
of 1,000 years of shared culture that is now defined by mutual admiration and kinship.
And Macron, noting that in 2027, William the Conqueror has his 1,000th birthday, said this.
France will loan the United Kingdom's Bayeux tapestry.
The Bayeux Tapestry is the earliest known depiction of that 1066 battle and the world's first war propaganda, woven in wool on linen. It looks like a 230-foot comic strip, complete with that scene of King Harold with an arrow in his eye. Sewn in England, it was plundered away to Bayeux, France. But next year, for the first time in 900 or so years, it is coming home. On loan to London's British Museum, which is home to more than a few things plundered from elsewhere.
They are very sticky diplomatic things.
Sarah Baxter, who studied history at Oxford, as you heard earlier, says the return of the Bayeux Tapestry is part of a bigger trend of museums giving things back. She serves on the advisory board of the Parthenon Project, lobbying the British Museum to return the so-called Elgin marbles to Greece, where they were plundered from the Parthenon. She's hopeful that museums may be catching up with modern sensibilities. The British Museum has already given back some of the Benin bronzes to modern-day Nigeria.
There's a lot of talk about slippery slopes and museums emptying, but I think what the Bayeux Tapestry coming to Britain does show, though, is the power of a partnership, is the diplomatic solution.
The power of a partnership to overcome who conquered who back in 1066 and share what's left of that history. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
You're listening to NPR News.
You are listening to Weekend Edition this Sunday morning here on member-supported KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, announcing the release of the new Full Stinger Variety Pack, featuring the Blood Orange IPA and Lemon Drop Blonde. Available in liquor stores now. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. United Way of Bemidji and the Community Resource Connections are coordinating storm relief efforts like debris removal and more for residents on private property. Find resources at 218-333-0880 or crcinform.org. Pay nothing to get that old or damaged car towed away, even if it doesn't run. Your donation of a car, boat, or other vehicle is tax deductible. You save time and money while defending the KAXE programs you love. Call 855-277-2346 for details. Now we'll take you back to Weekend Edition.
I'm Luis Schiavone with these headlines. Mexico's President Claudia Sheinbaum says she is optimistic about agreeing to a tariff rate with the United States before an August 1st deadline. This after President Trump declared he's imposing a 30% tariff on Mexico and the European Union. In the Middle East, Gaza health officials say the Palestinian death toll in the 21-month-long war there stands at more than 58,000. The conflict began almost 2 years ago with a brutal Hamas attack inside Israel. In finals play at Wimbledon today, 11 a.m. Eastern time, Carlos Alcaraz takes on Jannik Sinner for the men's trophy. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Progressive, with small business insurance for protecting a variety of business types with multiple coverage options designed to fit business owners' needs. More about small business insurance is at progressivecommercial.com. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. After deadly floods struck Texas 10 days ago, conspiracy theories soon followed. Rumors are circulating online claiming that a weather modification technology used to combat droughts may have led to the tragedy. Experts say this is part of a growing trend of misinformation springing up after natural disasters. Joining me with more is Mose Bouchel from member station KUT in Austin. Good morning.
Hi, Aisha.
So walk us through this. What are these rumors?
So the main one this time around has to do with cloud seeding. Okay, this is a practice of releasing tiny particles into clouds to try to encourage rain. It doesn't create clouds, but the point is to increase the rain that falls from them. And this has been around for decades. There's some mixed evidence about its effectiveness. But after this disaster, some online accounts pointed to a cloud seeding operation that happened in a different part of Texas a couple days prior to the floods. And the theories just kind of took off from there.
But experts say this isn't true, right? Cloud seeding had nothing to do with the floods.
Correct. Absolutely correct. Victor Murphy is a recently retired National Weather Service meteorologist. Here's how he put it to me.
There is zero science whatsoever out there, Mose, zero, that correlates these two.
Nevertheless, we heard some public figures amplify these theories. Right after the floods, Georgia Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene tweeted that she was introducing a bill to ban cloud seeding and other weather modification.
Is this the first time we've seen conspiracy theories pop up about weather manipulation?
No. They've been around for a while, but they've recently really taken off. Amber Silver is a professor at State University of New York at Albany who studies misinformation and natural disasters. She says trust in public institutions is low. The internet has put more people into online echo chambers. So when catastrophes happen and people are looking for answers, these false narratives get amplified really quickly. She says it's hard to counter those narratives.
Unfortunately, we know from the research that saying that's wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, isn't the way to do it, because people tend to just entrench themselves in their own beliefs. And no one likes to feel like, oh, I was wrong, or, you know, this person is calling me stupid or whatever else.
She says fighting misleading info is really better done by trusted community voices outside the context of a disaster, when emotions just aren't so high.
Have we been hearing from those trusted community voices in Texas?
Yeah, we've heard a lot just from like local TV and weather radio people pushing back against this. On Monday, Texas Senator Ted Cruz visited the hardest hit part of the state and warned people against trusting online rumors. The CEO of this cloud company, Rainmaker, has also been speaking out publicly. The EPA, without mentioning these floods specifically, also posted online information explaining the science of some of this stuff. But despite all that, a lot of people at the local level think these conspiracy theories are a distraction from the really important questions that have to be asked about how this natural disaster could have been handled better. Troy Kimmel is an emergency management response meteorologist in Austin.
There's no good news coming out of this, but we're trying to offer people closure. And I think we got other problems on our plate right now, and I don't think this needs to distract us.
He worries that these more outlandish theories will get in the way of looking at what really happened so that emergency officials can improve their communication and response next time.
That's Mose Bouchel with KUT in Austin. Thanks, Mose.
Thank you.
About 11% of adults in the U.S. take antidepressants, and in recent years, more patients have come forward to talk about how they've struggled with symptoms of withdrawal after they stopped taking the medication. A new study released last week renewed debate about the scale of this problem with antidepressants and the gaps in what we know. NPR's Will Stone has been covering this topic and joins me. Hi, Will.
Hey there.
Let's start with this new research. Why did this study get a lot of attention?
Well, it's wading into a very controversial topic in psychiatry, especially in the UK. There's increasing concern about how often people struggle with symptoms when they stop antidepressants, most commonly prescribed being SSRIs. So this study was just published in a top medical journal, JAMA Psychiatry. It analyzed existing data from about 50 clinical trials that amounts to more than 17,000 patients and found a person who goes off these medications experiences, on average, one more symptom compared to those who stop a placebo or continue with the treatment within the first week. Basically, the authors conclude it's below the threshold for what's considered clinically significant. Dr. Samir Johar led the study and is a psychiatrist at Imperial College London.
It's finding that there are clinical symptoms of withdrawal that you don't see with placebo, namely nausea, vertigo, dizziness. That maps onto the pharmacological basis for the drugs, and that these exist. They're just not very common.
One thing to note is this work was not really designed to quantify overall just how often these symptoms happen.
So do we have an answer to that question? How often do people have withdrawal symptoms?
Well, the short answer is not really. There's not good data here. There was another analysis of the existing evidence last year that found 15% of patients had withdrawal symptoms when you factored in placebo, and most of these were not severe. Now, the fundamental problem here is there really aren't high-quality trials that have specifically focused on measuring withdrawal symptoms. And the data out there tends to be from people who were on the drugs for a short period of time.
And what's the matter with focusing on people on it for a short period of time?
Well, the main critique from researchers and patients is that the biggest problems come in when people are on these drugs for years. One prominent voice in this debate is John Reed. He's a clinical psychologist at the University of East London. He's very critical of this new study and its conclusions.
They're saying it is not a clinically significant phenomenon, and that's not something you can compromise on. That is completely inaccurate, outrageous, and misleading to the public.
Now, the backstory here is Reed worked on another review study back in 2019. They found about half of people have withdrawal symptoms and that many were severe. They did not just include high-quality, randomized controlled trials, though. They factored in patient surveys. And the pushback there from Dr. Johar and others is this led to an overinflated and alarmist picture.
It really sounds like there's a lot of uncertainty here. How are others in psychiatry reacting?
Yeah, without some new trials, this isn't going to be resolved in any definitive way. I spoke to Avais Aftab about this. He's a psychiatrist at Case Western Reserve University who was not involved in any of these studies. He thinks the methodology in the JAMA study was solid, but he worries the authors underplayed the extent of the problem.
The danger there is that the profession and the public can take the wrong message from looking at this paper and say, oh, withdrawal is not a big issue, it's not a big deal. That would absolutely be the wrong conclusion. The study opens more questions than it answers.
Aftab says this has become incredibly polarized. On the one hand, psychiatrists are legitimately worried this could discourage people from taking antidepressants, which can be life-saving. But on the other, and NPR just reported on this, there is a movement of patients who describe debilitating symptoms after stopping these medications.
That's NPR's Will Stone. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
This week, high school teacher John Scopes went on trial in Tennessee for teaching human evolution. The historic case was later dramatized in the play and film Inherit the Wind.
I object.
On what grounds is it possible that something is holy to the celebrated agnostic?
Yes. The individual human mind.
Remembering the Scopes monkey trial, later today on All Things Considered, tell your smart speaker to play your local station by name. Summertime brings trips to the beach. And while most of us like to sit by the ocean, NPR's Shortwave podcast is diving in with this story from producer Hannah Chin on how the ocean and the atmosphere affect each other.
If you've ever walked along the beach and picked up a seashell, chances are it was brought to you by an ocean current. Those currents are like rivers and streams, but in the sea instead of on land. They're driven by temperature, salinity, coastlines, wind patterns, and even the rotation of the Earth. And as they wind through the ocean, they take things with them, like seashells or fish or even humans.
People have needed to know surface currents ever since they were sailing, you know, thousands of years ago. It's very, very important for navigation.
This is physical oceanographer Lynn Talley. She's a professor at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego. And she told me that one big surface current that affects us was first mapped by Benjamin Franklin because he was trying to solve the problem of mail. See, airmail wasn't an option at the time, so everything from England had to come via boat over the Atlantic Ocean. That could take multiple weeks, and Franklin wanted to speed that up.
So he noticed that his cousin in Rhode Island, who was a whaling captain, could get across the Atlantic Ocean a whole lot faster than the British official postmaster ships. And that's because his cousin knew about the Gulf Stream.
The Gulf Stream is a big current that flows from the Gulf of Mexico north along the eastern coastline of the United States and then towards northern Europe. And for a long time, the Gulf Stream and the majority of these surface currents have stayed the same. But now, they're shifting. An oceanographer named Xiangping Xie, who's a colleague of Talley's at the Scripps Institution, has used predictive models to show that in a warming climate, more than three quarters of the ocean's surface currents will significantly accelerate by the end of the century. That's because the ocean absorbs a lot of the heat that humans produce with greenhouse gases. And that heat, Xie told me, doesn't diffuse evenly. It tends to sit on the top.
You know, the ocean is a layer of warm water floating over a body of a deeper cold water.
As that top layer warms, water molecules within the surface currents move faster and further apart, meaning they're going to take up more space. That'll result in intensified pressure differences, pushing parts of the ocean to speed up.
The speed up of the currents is associated with tremendous changes of the ocean temperature and salinity. So fish definitely is going to tell the difference. Because, you know, a lot of fish, they migrate among spawning and feeding and the nursery grounds.
There is one key exception to this overall surface acceleration trend, and that's the AMOC, or Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. It's a system of surface currents and deep currents, kind of like a big ocean conveyor belt that moves warm water north and cold water south. And instead of speeding up, the AMOC is slowing down, which could change a whole host of things, increase storm severity, cause sea level rise, make Western Europe and a lot of the Northern Hemisphere way colder, change monsoon season and rainfall near the equator. Scientists don't know all the potential effects yet. That's in part because when it comes to climate science, the ocean is understudied.
Climate change is often presented as an atmospheric problem. There are just much fewer studies on how the ocean responds.
But Xie says we need those additional studies, because even though the ocean isn't our home, we can't survive climate change without it. Hannah Chin, NPR News.
This story is a part of Shortwave's Sea Camp series. Follow the podcast and subscribe to their newsletter at npr.org/seacamp to learn more. The Denver Museum of Nature and Science just got a reminder of an old lesson. Location, location, location. The museum has a very popular dinosaur exhibit. You can even take a selfie with a T-Rex skull. But the museum's newest fossil wasn't found in a faraway cave or valley. It was under its own parking lot. The museum was exploring the idea of geothermal heating for the building, so they drilled a 750-foot deep hole there, and they found something, all right. But it wasn't steam. It was a fossil. It's too small to know what it is exactly, but experts are guessing a duck-billed dinosaur. Here's the thing. The hole was deep, but it was only 5 inches wide. Finding a dinosaur fossil anywhere in the world this way is highly improbable. Only two have been found through an opening this small before. James Hagedorn, the museum's curator of geology, says finding a fossil underneath the parking lot is like hitting a hole in one from the moon. It's like winning the Willy Wonka factory. Museum officials say there are no plans to dig further under the parking lot because, well, people need a place to park when they come to visit.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
North Carolina is expected to have one of the most competitive U.S. Senate races next year. The state's political landscape shifted further when two-term Republican Senator Tom Tillis announced he won't seek re-election. That leaves the race with no clear frontrunners in either party, with 8 months to go before the primary. I'm joined by Colin Campbell, Capital Bureau Chief for Member Station WUNC, to hear more about this seat. Hi, Colin.
Hey, Ayesha.
So first, remind us why Tillis dropped out.
Yeah, so this happened pretty suddenly last month when the Senate was debating President Trump's mega bill. Tillis said the proposed changes to Medicaid would make it impossible for him to vote yes. He was particularly concerned that the bill was going to end Medicaid expansion in North Carolina, effectively kicking more than 600,000 people off the health care program who've really only joined in the past 2 years. So within hours of that, Tillis's comments provoked a pretty serious backlash from President Trump. He threatened on social media to endorse a primary challenger, and then the following day, we got the announcement from Tillis that he won't be running again.
Have any big-name Republicans in North Carolina launched Senate campaigns since Tillis dropped out?
So far, no one has formally declared their candidacy, but plenty of Republicans have been saying they're considering a run. It's something of a waiting game because most everyone in the GOP thinks their nominee will be whoever Trump endorses in the end. And then the most obvious person for the president to endorse would be his daughter-in-law, Laura Trump. She co-chaired the Republican National Committee until pretty recently, and she told Fox News she's considering a Senate run here. She grew up in the Wilmington area and still has family there, but ultimately she'd have to move back to the state if she jumps in the race. I think Democrats would probably make that an issue if she runs, but moving states to run for the Senate isn't exactly unheard of. Elizabeth Dole moved back to North Carolina after decades away, and she got elected back in 2002.
Yeah, who are the other Republicans considering a Senate run?
Another name that keeps coming up is Michael Whatley, the chair of the Republican National Committee. He actually led the North Carolina GOP before Trump elevated him to the national role. And several North Carolina's congressmen, Republicans, have said that they're going to be interested in this race.
And what about the Democratic side?
It's pretty empty for the moment. Former Congressman Wiley Nickel has so far been the only declared candidate for months now, and that's because everyone is waiting to see if former Democratic Governor Roy Cooper jumps in the race. His team says he'll make a decision soon, and since he won the state by a pretty big margin in 2020, even as Trump won North Carolina, Democrats pretty much think he's their best shot at flipping the seat, which would be for the first time since 2008.
What do you see as some of the top issues driving this race?
I think you'll see Democrats put health care issues front and center. If the changes to Medicaid, as we were mentioning in the debate from the mega bill, result in people losing their health care coverage here, the Democratic candidate is going to tie their opponent to this mega bill. It's pretty much easy enough to do if the GOP candidate ends up being a member of Congress who voted for the bill or if it's someone close to Trump. And then on the Republican side, immigration, I think, could be a big focus. North Carolina isn't particularly close to the border, but that was a winning issue for the GOP here in the last election.
How does North Carolina and the Senate race fit into the bigger picture of next year's midterms?
There are only a few competitive Senate races on the ballot in 2026 all across the country, and this is one of them. Democrats will have an uphill battle winning control of the Senate, and if they don't win in North Carolina, it's next to impossible for them to flip enough seats to get that majority. North Carolina is considered a swing state. You know, we often elect Democrats for governor at the same time that the state goes red in presidential elections. But Republicans have won every Senate race here since 2008, and Trump has won the state 3 times. So even without an incumbent senator like Tillis, it's going to be a pretty tough race for the Democrats.
Colin Campbell covers North Carolina politics for Member Station WUNC. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Ayesha.
This is NPR News.
You're tuned in to Weekend Edition here on member-supported KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kivi, exploring the distinctly American art form. Hear more Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer-hosted Jazz on America Avenue. Beltrami Soil and Water Conservation District will celebrate their 75th anniversary Friday, July 18th from 5 to 7 at Mobile Maze Recreation Area. Enjoy a cookout and refreshments and learn about shoreline health and other programs that the group offers. Grand Rapids Riverfest is Saturday, September 6th. This year's lineup, Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Ellen Sparhawk. Tickets and info at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. French President Emmanuel Macron called on European countries to remain firm and united as President Trump calls for 30% tariffs on EU products. The tariffs go into effect if no deal is reached by August 1st. North Korea's Kim Jong-un met this weekend with visiting Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. State media in Pyongyang says the North has expressed unconditional support for all actions taken by Russian leadership to resolve the war in Ukraine. The death toll from the catastrophic flooding of the Guadalupe River in central Texas stands at 128 so far, with at least 160 missing. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at raymondjames.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Birth rates are falling here in the U.S. and many parts of the world. Much of the attention has focused on declining populations in East Asia and Europe. But the number of babies being born in Latin America is also plummeting. NPR's Brian Mann traveled to Chile's capital, Santiago, where he found the debate over children and population could foreshadow the national debate growing in the U.S.
I'm walking through a market in a working-class neighborhood in Santiago. The snow-capped Andes mountains glow in the distance. But here on the street, it's all business. Marisol Romero is selling little dolls and flowers. I'm here the week before Mother's Day, and Romero is hoping shoppers will buy presents for their mom. She's in her 50s and comes from a big family. She was one of eight kids. I ask how many children she had.
Dos.
Why did you choose to have only two and not more?
Por el costo de la vida.
Life is expensive, she says. So if you had money freedom, you would maybe have had more.
Sí. Mi ideal eran cinco.
Romero tells me she wanted five kids but settled for two. I've come to Chile because this country's demographic shift in many ways mirrors trends in the United States. The total fertility rate in the U.S., the number of children the average woman will have in her lifetime, has dropped to its lowest level ever, around 1.6. That's well below the threshold of 2.1 kids researchers say is needed to maintain a stable population. Chile was at that level a decade ago, but the country's total fertility rate has plunged to just one child per woman. Martina Llopo Diaz is a sociologist at Santiago's Catholic University.
Today we have a total fertility rate that is lower than most European countries, lower than Japan's.
The latest United Nations report found more than 1 in 10 countries around the world now have Chile's kind of hyper-low fertility. Llopo Diaz and other experts think life in Chile could change fast as the population ages and begins to shrink.
I think this has huge implications for which we're not prepared as a society. Key social systems, from the economy to the labor market to pensions, are based on the principle that there will be new generations to replace the old ones. But now we see that that principle is no longer something that we can, you know, take as given.
It's unclear whether the U.S. fertility rate will keep dropping as Chile's has done. But there's one way the two countries are similar. A fast-growing number of women in the U.S. and Chile are delaying motherhood much later in life, and in many cases, opting out altogether.
No.
I meet Florencia Contreras, who's 23, on the street with her friends near the university in Santiago where they're art students. Contreras tells me, no, she doesn't want kids.
Sí, que creo que es...
I don't want it to sound ugly, but I feel like motherhood is a burden.
Her fellow student, Macarena Lagos, who's 19, speaks up.
No quiero tener hijos.
Para nada.
I don't want kids either. Not at all.
They tell me they think being mothers would mean a loss of freedom, a loss of autonomy over their bodies and their lives. Now, there's a second way the birth rate debate in Chile sounds a lot like the U.S. Some politicians in Chile, conservatives and leaders on the far right, have begun talking about ways to encourage women to have more babies. Lagos says this pressure makes her angry.
No matter what the government does, it's still my decision, my own. No matter what the government does, I don't think my decision will change.
It's important to say many officials in Chile's current progressive government see this independence for women, this resistance to traditional roles, not as a problem, but as a sign of hard-won progress. Antonio Orellana is Chile's Minister of Women and Gender Equity.
We have to discuss this as a government who has a commitment with the feminist ideas.
Orellana acknowledges Chile's plunging birth rate is a real concern for the country's economy and social fabric, but she says it's important to focus also on the rising number of women getting college degrees and entering the workforce. Orellana points to a third way the trend in Chile parallels what's happening in the U.S., success reducing birth rates among adolescents.
We have almost erased the teen pregnancy within the last 20 years.
Conservative leaders in Chile see birth rates as a much more immediate crisis. José Antonio Kast is a leading populist candidate in this year's presidential race. He posted a campaign video celebrating what he describes as women's traditional role as mothers.
El vínculo materno-infantil es tremendo.
Mothers are essential. The mother-child bond is tremendous, Kast says. A society that wants to develop well needs this emotional bond. Chile's influential Roman Catholic Church has also taken up the cause of motherhood and population.
La natalidad es un tema de largo aliento que hay que verlo con urgencia.
In an interview with the national TV station TVN, the Archbishop of Santiago, Fernando Chomalí, called these population trends an urgent problem. The birth rate we have today, he warned, is practically zero. There's a fourth way. This debate over population in Chile sounds a lot like what's happening in the U.S., and that's the question of immigration. Until recently, Chile took in a lot of refugees from Haiti, Venezuela, and other countries. Now many conservatives here want to close Chile's borders and deport migrants. Sociologist Martina Yopo Diaz says that kind of policy would send Chile's birth rate plunging even lower.
One out of five children that are born in Chile are born to foreign mothers, and the northern regions of the country is one out of two.
In the U.S., meanwhile, a study by the Brookings Institution found without a lot of migrants and the children of migrants, the United States could lose a third of its population in this century. But in Chile, as in the U.S., Yopo Diaz says many on the right now view migrants not as a positive, but as a threat, a kind of invasion.
This is creating very important cultural and social tensions in the country. There's a lot of people fueling right-wing discourses about anxieties about, you know, that we are becoming extinguished as a nation.
While in Santiago, I heard one more way Chile's conversation about birth rates and babies matches what NPR is finding in the U.S. Politicians and activists often make these demographic trends sound apocalyptic. But when we talk to women, it doesn't sound grim at all. In Santiago, most women tell me they see their country changing in big ways, but they're happy to be making their own choices. I ask Marisol Romero, the shopkeeper in the market, whether her decision to have fewer children made her sad. She smiles and shakes her head.
No, because I accepted it, and I love my children and now my grandchildren very much.
Romero says her two kids have now decided to have only one baby each, an even smaller version of family, she says already feels normal. Brian Mann, NPR News.
In a new murder mystery, a young woman, Olivia Blunt, is eager to impress her new boss, the no-nonsense detective, Aubrey Merritt. They have a big case hours away in Vermont. Merritt doesn't drive. Blunt does. The vehicle, a rattle trap of a Jeep with 200,000 miles on it.
At exactly 8 o'clock, Merritt emerged from the building. She was always punctual and abhorred people who weren't. Her disapproval extended to early birds as well as latecomers, which was why I hadn't gone to her door when I'd arrived 15 minutes ahead of schedule. I watched as she paused on the arched portico, and I clearly registered the exact moment when, looking up the street, she caught sight of me sitting behind the wheel of my ancient rusted vehicle. Her standard resting face, never free from a pinch of suspicion, was overcome by a surge of horror, which curled into snobbish disgust, which subsided into resignation. I gave an awkward little wave.
The world's greatest detective and her just-okay assistant is the new novel from Liza Tully. That's the pen name of Elizabeth Brinks, who also writes under the pen name Elizabeth Elo. Liza Tully, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, so tell us about this just-okay assistant, Olivia Blunt. Who is she, and why does she want to work for Aubrey Merritt?
Well, Olivia Blunt is a 25-year-old fact checker for an online media business, and she has always had a love of detective fiction. And when she realizes there's an opening for an assistant to a really nationally renowned private investigator, she really wants to get that job. So she interviews for it, and in fact, she does get it, even though the interview was kind of a disaster on many levels. But her fact-checking skills really impressed the detective, Aubrey Merritt.
So Merritt, she's an older woman, very sophisticated, but she doesn't, you know, suffer fools or hapless assistants. In a way, you can look at her as this regal kind of almost Angela Lansbury, almost Murder, She Wrote, but she's no J.B. Fletcher because she's not very warm and nice. She's prickly. What drives Merritt?
Well, Merritt is a detective who, you know, she doesn't have special skills like Sherlock Holmes or even Poirot. She's a woman who has worked for 30 years to build her business, and she has done it the hard way, and she's got a lot of experience and a lot of smarts. And she does her detecting through three things: observation, logic, and psychology. And she believes that these are things that she can teach to anyone, even Olivia Blunt. But she's also spent 30 years of her life thinking about murder and about really like bad people doing bad things to each other. So she's kind of weary, and she's not really down with, you know, having too much empathy for her subjects.
The pairing, when you think about it, is kind of like that TV comedy Hacks. You have this older, established woman who's a bit jaded, and then you have the younger, often kind of impulsive woman, maybe a little more idealistic. What made you want to write a book with this dynamic, and especially in this genre of murder mystery?
Well, murder mysteries are kind of famous for having detective duos.
Yeah.
But a lot of times the assistant isn't as smart as the detective.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought of that as kind of a wasted opportunity. So in Olivia's case, she is smart and she is capable of being a great detective herself someday. But there's a temperamental difference and an experiential difference.
The death that they're investigating, it's kind of, you know, delectable murder mystery stuff. You have this older, rich widow who police say jumped off her balcony at her resort at Lake Champlain. And then there's this strange suicide note. But there's something wrong with that picture. I mean, I didn't like the whole jumping off the balcony thing. That just already seemed a little off to me for an older woman jumping off the balcony. What was wrong with this picture? Don't tell us. Don't spoil us. But you know what I mean.
Well, absolutely. And actually, one of the victim's name is Victoria. And actually, one of her friends says that's not like Vicky at all. There's a lot that's wrong with it. And also her daughter, Victoria's daughter, Haley, she says my mother was a very fun-loving person who was really generous and warm and kind and gave a lot to other people. So it was not somebody you would expect to have taken their own life.
One thing that I also found very fascinating was that the way Merritt, when she was interrogating people, she would talk to them very differently, kind of based on their position. Can you explain how that worked? Because Olivia seemed a little bit taken aback by it.
Yes, and there's one scene in which Merritt interviews a housekeeper, and she's pretty harsh with her, and Olivia feels very sympathetic to her and actually scolds Merritt a little bit afterwards and says, you know, you didn't have to be too hard on her. And Merritt says, look, we're here to find a murderer. We're not social workers. And that was kind of a slap in Olivia's face. But Olivia is going to hang on to the way she sees the world and the way she sees people. And that's one of the tensions between the two women.
But then Merritt's very nice to the rich people, but she's like buttering them up.
She's very good at manipulating people. So when somebody is, for example, a mansplainer, well, she'll flatter him. So she's very good at understanding how to get people to talk to her.
How do you figure out how to lay out the stories and then dribble the clues in and all of that?
Well, I work a lot in a notebook before I even start a draft. I kind of get a feel for what has a certain sparkle to me and what I want to write about. And then I just kind of wing it. I think in this case, you know, it's hard to plant a clue ahead of time because it depends so much on where the person is standing. There's a scene in this book, and I'm not giving anything away by saying one of the clues is a light that's going down a road on a very dark night. That clue is seen by a character who's standing on a porch on this night. I don't know how to plan for that. So that's something that happened as I was writing.
But did you know that, so as you were writing that came up, did you know exactly who had that light when you wrote it?
I didn't know. I had an idea.
Oh, you didn't know. Oh, okay.
No, I don't know exactly, but I know that that's going to be a clue, and I know it's going to be an important clue. Mm. And then a lot of times I'm going back all the time.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of going back and rewriting to make that clue actually mean something in the book.
Why do you think so many people are fascinated by murder mysteries? Like what do we get out of reading these?
The thing that people always say is, well, there's disorder and the detective comes along and creates order and that makes everybody feel good.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think there's another reason too, and that is that, especially in this kind of murder mystery, where it's not a psychopath, it's not a serial killer, the person who does the killing is actually an average sort of person. If you look at the suspects, you can't tell which one actually did the murder. Underneath everything else, it becomes a story about motive. And then it also becomes a story about someone having some emotion, whether it's greed or anger or lust or something like that, that just crosses a line into their being willing to do something really horrendous. And that, to me, is the fascination of it. Most of us can stop before we do something terrible. And so this is generally a story about somebody who couldn't stop, and they went on to do the terrible thing. So it's about human nature.
That's Liza Tully. Her new book is The World's Greatest Detective and Her Just Okay Assistant. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. From Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at cigna.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Power Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXC.org. Minnesota Mixtape is our deep dive into the local music scene, Fridays at 10 a.m. and Saturdays at 3 p.m. with host Malachi Coons. Mesabi Musical Theater presents Rodgers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma, July 24th and 25th at 7 p.m. at Hibbing High School. There will also be a Sunday matinee on July 27th at 2 p.m. Find tickets and more info at MesabiMusicalTheater.com. Watermark Arts Center.